Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Jed Hartley, son of a false prophet and former member of the International House of Prayer. Jed, it's good to be back and to talk about using the Bible as a whiplash. I've mentioned this last time, but there were certain verses and phrases that we would use that just had all of that loaded language in it, and you would be sitting there in the pew and you would know that you were getting whipped from the pulpit. In fact, I think I've mentioned this. I remember clearly as I think I was in my teens, I walked outside of a church building and I was walking, you know, the men would walk to this corner, the women would walk over here. It was kind of odd now that I think about that, but walked over to the men and they said, "Boy, we sure got a good tongue lashing today, didn't we, brethren?" And everybody just laughing about it. And I think about how different that is once we left that and went to a church where they actually preached what's in the Bible in context without loading specific passages to have all of this hidden meanings. And it's just such a different world that that we left and that we went to, and hopefully that there are other people who can leave the whiplashing and, and enter into something that's peaceful.
Well, I think that's such a good example of what we'll talk about today, of that sort of using the Bible to contextualize things that are happening in life, either to excuse behavior or to condemn behavior. And it's totally up to whoever is making the narrative. It's so apparent, especially when you get outside of the community, but despite it being so apparent, so on the nose, it is used so frequently within all of these circles.
It reminds me so much of the different things that I had to, you know, grow up with. The verse that I mentioned whenever we first began the last podcast, you know, over and over in my head, I think of this every time I drive past the place where we used to go to church, because they would take verses like that and just beat us over the head with it. Mm-hmm. And then when we left and we started attending real churches, and I'm saying that with the straightest face that I can, we left a fake church and we went to a real church. In the real church, they were trying to give you passages that made you feel peace and security and all of the blessings that God intends to give you. That's what the new churches had. The old churches, you just simply felt like you're being beat over the head while you're sitting there in the pew.
Yeah, and there is no consistency. If you have a church that has no integrity, which is... And it is not about building consistent behavior, but it's about building power structures. You have these, you have these verses, or just the Bible in general is used as a whipping tool. It's about keeping people in line. And so the consistency of it is totally all over the place. And so I know that we've now probably spent several of our podcasts that talking about Jen Johnson's response to, if people haven't seen the previous ones, Jen Johnson, the daughter-in-law to Bill Johnson and one of the leaders and primary musicians at Bethel Music, had a interview where she talked about some of the people who have recently had very significant scandals involving sexual indiscretion, sexual like grooming, and I mean serious behavior. And I always want to say sin because just that's what I grew up with. It's so impossible to rework your language as you grow up. But everything that I can think of is when I say people who were caught in severe sexual sin, that's the way they talk about it. And that's the way it's hard for me not to talk about it. I think that it at times minimizes what is going on because, again, the way that sexual sin is used is so broad that it can refer to, there's a large scale of that. But anyway, The point is that there was several people who have had some really significant scandals and individuals who have come forward, victims who have come forward, who have told really heartbreaking stories. I'm not going to rehash all of that. If people want to go back and watch those episodes again to get a better understanding of the context, but I really wanted to continue to address how Jen Johnson responded to it, because I think it gives such a poignant example of many of the things that we have talked about and many of the things that you and I, John, and other people who grew up in New Apostolic Reformation communities faced with this judgment for you, but not for me, where we see people who are involved in really horrific, abusive situations, who are perpetuating some serious abuse, who should be being held accountable for their actions, and yet somehow they're off scot-free. So I talked a lot about the specific things that Jen Johnson spoke, but I have one paragraph that I'll read, and I don't know if you've seen this or watched it, John, yet, but I'm quoting her verbatim, and it's all in one paragraph, and she gets like four examples of this in one single paragraph. So it's a very poignant example of exactly what I'm talking about, what we've been talking about. But in when referencing Ben Armstrong and Sean Bowles and these my own father, these individuals who have been accused of extremely serious things, and she gives a sort of defense where she says, you know, we have all sinned, we have all fallen short. He who is without sin cast the first stone. And so I think there's a lot of difficult things that people are trying to accomplish on the internet that need to happen again, like Paul said, face to face, and need to be tried and executed and processed in court, and not just opinions flying around on the internet. So that was her statement there. So in that statement, you get, well, three biblical allusions there. You get, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. She doesn't say the full passage. She then goes straight into, he who is without sin cast the first stone. So you have a little bit of Romans, you have a little bit of, I think it's John 8 with the story of Jesus with the adulterous woman. And then she references something which I was thinking, I have no idea what she was talking about when she said, like Paul said, face to face and need to be tried and executed and processed in court. I have no idea what that reference is to. I don't know if she's confusing things. Like, I know there's the Matthew 18 that Jesus talks about, you know, a process. That this Matthew 18 we've talked about in the past, because IHOP used it a bunch, of like having to have the victim go face to face with their accuser, which was a poor, it always was a poor use of Matthew 18. But here, I don't even know what she's referencing when she talks about Paul, because that was Matthew. So I don't know what she's talking about when she says Paul said face to face and need to be tried and executed and processed in court. But she's clearly appealing to a sort of biblical authority in this paragraph. I mean, it wasn't written, it was spoken, but in this little section that she was talking about, she's clearly using an appeal to biblical authority in order to condemn internet voices who are speaking against her friends and these leaders who have been accused of these things. Which, again, I think we talked about this a lot on the previous episode, so I don't want to hammer this point again, but when she talks about the internet people, she's talking about you and me, John, and she's talking about the victims. Those are the people who are talking about this. And you and me and other, it's not like we're the only people who are talking on podcasts about some of the things that is going on with Bethel. But everybody that I know who is talking about this was involved with these communities to some point. Like, I was directly involved and was very close, and I would speak to Bethel directly if they gave me the option to. And then you have the victims who are clearly involved in the situation, and they're speaking up. And then you have other voices like the Mike Wingers who are trying to amplify the voice of the victims and have spoken directly to the victims or spoken to people like me who were directly, you know, firsthand accounts of some of the abusive patterns of some of these abusers with my father and with Sean Bowles. And anyway, the point being is, like, there is, she is using biblical allusions to silence and condemn critics while also contextualizing them, pretending like they are random people talking on the internet instead of people who are directly involved with these things. And it was so, when I watched this the first time, it was so infuriating to me because I just have seen this pattern happen many times before where people, we're talking about accountability of individuals who have groomed and abused, sexually abused people. This is not the time to throw in obscure biblical references in order to contextualize and condone these horrific behaviors. And yet, the first instinct is, oh, someone who I like and who I care about is being accused of something horrific. And rather than coming to terms with the fact that, oh my goodness, I might not have known this person like I thought I did, or, oh my goodness, this person did something horrible, and I have to come to terms with that. Instead, it's this reactive, I am going to reference a verse that I don't really even understand or am thinking about in the moment in order to quiet my own cognitive dissonance and reaffirm my position of authority within this community. Because if this person is held accountable, then my power structure begins to dissolve. People begin to question Bethel, and my own position of authority becomes minimized and whatnot. And so, and it's so clear that that's happening. I mean, there is not any semblance of anything other than that. Like, this, it is explicitly what is going on, and people are so emboldened in these New Apostolic Reformation communities where leaders are so emboldened to use these passages, biblical passages, as whipping posts, you know, to either condemn people or to absolve people, basically without any consistency.
I was thinking as you were talking and struggling not to laugh, if you couldn't tell, because it struck me funny all of a sudden. What you're describing, I call apostolic sermon salad. And, you know, if she's not a minister, then it would be just apostolic word salad. But they like to take a verse here that they have already overloaded the meaning. So in your head, you're programmed, just that phrase has an entire book of meaning. And they start communicating like this. So if you're part of the congregation and you have learned all the loaded language, then you understand all of it. But picture an outsider who comes in. They're like, wait a minute, those two verses don't really go together. What are they talking about? Mm-hmm. And it reminds me, you can, this will go probably way over your head and most of the audience too. You can tell a true Star Trek fan if you say Shaka when the walls fell, and they know what you're talking about. And I'll explain it for those who aren't, because I'm sure most of you are not. The Enterprise encounters this entire civilization where they talk like Pentecostal people. They use phrases like this, and that phrase has significant meaning in this culture. And they keep saying it, and everybody on the aboard the Enterprise scratching their head, thinking, what are they talking about? That none of these things make sense. And then later in the episode, they find out, they're taking phrases, and this phrase has verbiage that is loaded language, and they mean this thing. And so I have come to terms with the fact that most of the religious faiths that were built off of this Pentecostal thing, they do this. Here's a phrase from the Bible. We've loaded the language. I can say it, and I don't have to tell you what it means. Let's go to the next phrase. Let's go to the next. Well, what happens when you take two phrases that don't have similar context and you piece them together? Well, like the Star Trek thing, you've got an entirely different language that means nothing. It's yep. word salad, right? And take it a step further, if you don't have the loaded language, or especially for the teenagers growing who haven't yet adopted the loaded language, they're just so confused. What is this thing called the Bible, and why is it like a puzzle they're preaching from? And this none of it makes any sense. But it goes back to what I said earlier about the way that they use the Bible as a weapon. They weaponize the phrases. And so when she's talking about Paul, I can't say what's in her head because I can't ask her at this moment, but more than likely it's similar to other things that I've heard. When people weaponize those languages, they'll take a phrase like this that is meant to say everybody's a sinner, take another phrase that is to God the glory, God's going to forgive you, and take, I think it's the part where Agrippa is coming, or Paul is standing before Caesar's judgment, and all of the defense comes up, and Paul says something to the effect that, If it comes to an execution, I'm ready to die, something like this. And when you phrase that, when you pull all those phrases together, you can trail it along and make it make a story, but it's not a story that's actually in the Bible because you've gone to different books, right? And the sad truth is they do it so much that in effect they're writing new Bible books and don't realize they're doing it. And you grow up in that environment. I grew up in that environment. I was a little surprised whenever I stopped reading the Bible according to phraseology, which is what we did, and just started reading it from chapter to chapter, verse by verse, all the way down through. I started reading it as a, here's a letter, here's a book, let's read the book, let's read the letter. And it started saying different things than they were saying whenever I was in the, listening to these sermons. Well, that's what they're doing. But to your point in all of this, it's insidious because they are dumbing down things that really need attention, and it destroys accountability. Because when you have a situation where somebody potentially has done something that is criminal, you can't really use those phrases and make them apply. Instead, you should be saying, we have a potential criminal act. Please keep your kids away until we determine it. Was this, did this really happen? Did this not? Keep your children safe. And then separate that from the context of the gospel that should be preached on Sunday. But what you have instead is they try to do this word salad, piecing all of these things together, and then they piece that in with it. Well, they're rewriting a new book, which has forgiveness, has all of the things that the gospel has, and then here's this situation that might be criminal, and what do you do with this? You lump it all together and say, he's part of our body, he's part of the elite, he's part of the forgiven, he's part of the chosen ones. And what does that say to every single person who has left? They're further victimized after leaving because now they're thinking, oh my gosh, every single person who's left doesn't have that same sympathy from them. And some of them were truly victims according to what, you know, what has come out in the news and in the court trials that have happened around some of the similar situations. So in my opinion, you can't keep doing this. You can't keep taking phrases and making new books. Otherwise, why do you carry the Bible to church? If you're not going to read the Bible, you're going to make new books. You don't even need the Bible. You just, you start speaking Shaka when the walls fell.
Right. I mean, well, and when you're reducing the Bible down to like these little kitschy phrases and whatnot, I mean, you can just piece those together to say whatever you want, which is, that's the strategy. That's not, like, this is not just criticizing Jen Johnson. Although I want to be clear, I am absolutely criticizing Jen Johnson for how she responded. Like, this is very personal in that respect too, because, you know, this is serious stuff. And I think that she is speaking in a way that really minimizes what is going on at Bethel, and in a way also minimizing the voice of the victims and the voice of you and I and other people who are wanting to see change and addressing some of these systemic issues there. So, I mean, this isn't, this is about her, but also on a larger sense, this is just the structure of all of these communities. So I don't fault her specifically for having this whimsical sort of like, let me just mosaic half of paraphrased verses from the Bible and put them together to weave my own little new narrative in a way that is obviously inconsistent with how I handle other situations when people are outside of my community or outside of the leadership of my community. But it is something that you see quite often. Are you familiar, John, with the Dunning-Kruger? I think I may have talked about this, but the Dunning-Kruger effect, have you heard of that?
It may have been from you or Brantley. I've heard it, but I can't recall what it is.
So there was a study that basically, to summarize the study, was about how people respond with specific subject or specific topics. The people's reported their understanding of what they know of that topic, like how much they are an expert on that topic. And if you have like a XY diagram of this, where, you know, the X is actual knowledge of the specific material and Y is sort of your reported understanding of that material, there's this interesting sort of pattern where, you know, it starts out low. People who know nothing of something report that they know nothing of something. They start to learn a little bit about it, and then it shoots really quickly up. So you can have, you know, a 3 out of 10 of knowledge on this domain or subject, but think that you're a 7 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10, because you literally have not learned enough to know how little you know. And then you start cresting that and coming back down as you continue to press in and learn more about the subject, and you realize, oh my goodness, there's all of these nuances. You know, I think about my own, I love football, and I have like, I delved into American football, like play calling, and I was like, oh man, I'm starting to get this. And I definitely went on that arc of being like, oh my goodness, I have no idea. You know, I have enough to, at a Sunday, you know, if there's people around who don't really know much about play calling, I can be like, oh, well, you know, this is a Tampa 2 coverage that they're in. And people will be like, wow, this guy knows a lot. So I know enough to pretend like I know something, but I'm like, I have absolutely no idea. I never played, you know, college football or high school football even. So if there was anybody who actually was there, who actually had been like involved in coaching to some extent, they would be like, this guy's a total idiot and is a moron and has no idea what's going on. And I've started learning enough where I'm now, you know, they call it the valley of despair, because you're just like, oh my goodness, I don't know and I will never know, because there's just so much information about any given topic. And
the funny part of that is the very reason why I modeled the podcast series like I did. I had somebody who told me originally, John, if you're going to do this right, you need to bring in the experts and have expert testimony. And I was thinking of exactly that. There isn't a single person who knows all of this history. You can't know all this history.
Yeah.
And if you divide it into silos of the different groups that have emerged, you can't even have a person who knows a fraction of the history.
Yeah.
But if you bring a bunch of people who have different experiences, different sets of knowledge, and then have everybody talk, you have a collective hive of information. And that's really why I did what I did.
And I get why people don't, which it takes so much work. It takes you like having to interview hundreds of people and having to have, you know, thousands of podcast episodes and doing all of these things and building out your entire website where you have all of these really, you know, so dense information and all these different things. And you would have the humility And you've demonstrated this before, even when talking about specific subjects. There will be many times where you're like, oh, well, I'm not an expert on that. I don't know who is an expert if it isn't you, but you have talked to people who know very specific slices of this world. And anyway, the point is that it requires one epistemic humility of being able to recognize, like, oh, I just don't know that much of this. And epistemic humility is not a virtue that is encouraged in the New Apostolic Reformation communities. It just isn't. And I can get back to that. But it requires humility, but it also requires effort. And it's not convenient because if we talk about something as vast and complex as understanding and knowing the Bible and knowing how verses are used, I remember when I first experienced this as a young, I don't want to say minister, but like in the New Apostolic Reformation, I was just as qualified as anyone because it was just anybody can speak. There was no, credentialing or no process of being ordained. It was just kind of, if you have something to say, say it. And my dad would elevate me a lot. So there was times where when I was in my early 20s, even in my teen years, I would go to different conferences and I would speak. And I thought, well, I was building my young sort of ministering career. And I think this was when I was in my late teens, early 20s. I remember my first message that I had. And I may have even referenced this in a previous podcast, but the first sort of sermon that I developed was around Isaiah 60, arise, shine, for your light has come and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. And this sort of like, I can't even remember exactly what my point was for it, but this sort of like, God has given us this moment, kings will be brought to the brightness of your dawn and everything like that. And using that as a metaphor and a sort of like, it was somewhere in between a sermon and a self-help discussion and a, like most New Apostolic Reformation sermons are. And I remember at some point I was like, I really should probably read the verses and chapters that come before Isaiah 60. And then only in that context did I recognize that it was literally a prophecy. Well, now I'm forgetting, but it was either a prophecy about... Oh, see, this is, I'm fully in the valley of despair and have not gotten out of it. But it was a specific prophecy about either a person or a nation. And I'm using it in 2010 United States to talk about me. Like, it was not about Jedediah. And I'm not saying that you can't use some of these passages and prophecies to emulate and support some larger things. Like, this was a prophecy that was given about Jesus, but it is also true to us and who walk in, the anointing of Christ. Like, I understand there probably was a nuanced way that I could have still given that sermon, but I recognized after already speaking to, thousands of people probably about that passage that I realized I don't really understand what I'm talking about at all. And I started realizing, like, I'm going to be a bad minister if I have these hesitancies, because now if I go up and preach and I'm like, well, so this is kind of not really about us, but it's something that we can do. And I give the proper caveat and I say, full, transparency, I haven't actually studied all of this. Everybody's going to be like, well, we're not listening to this kid. I need to go up there and preach with conviction. The same way, if I want people to think I'm smart when it comes to football, where I'm going to talk about Tampa 2 defense, even though they're in cover 3 or something like that, just because I don't actually know the terminology for the defense they're in, so I just need to sound smart. If the goal is sounding smart, it's a completely different game, And I truly think that for ministers within this larger community, it is about sounding like you know what you're talking about, and it sounding like you're referencing the Bible to emulate that you are someone in that 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, knowledge of Bible and biblical understanding. And it is so easy to pretend like you're there without doing any of the work and effort. And I say all of this not to criticize someone like a Jen Johnson and being like, oh, she doesn't actually know what she's talking about. It's not that. It's she is in a community that openly rewards people who do not delve deeper into the truth of what's going on, because humility is not very conducive to structures of power that exist there. Conviction and authority is all that matters. And it is easier to have conviction and authority by staying in that realm where you only know a little bit, but you think you know a lot. And again, to learn anything more, you would have to start going on that journey where you go through the valley of despair and realize, oh my goodness, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And all of these verses that we are using, you know, the we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That was in Romans, where Paul was talking about Jews and Gentiles and talking about larger groups of people, not individual, and about equating, you know, the Jews and Gentiles as similar under this sort of banner of sin. And yet that's not how it's used. And most people probably don't understand that and don't understand the context to it. And I don't even. Like, I'm saying that here not to be an authority of biblical knowledge, but to be an authority of biblical unknowledge. Like, I don't know enough about these things because they're incredibly complex and, you know, incredibly dense. Like, the people who are truly studied on this know just swaths of the Bible and not the Bible entirely, because it's just too much for people to totally have a perfect understanding of holistically. And so you have these people who are wielding it. I mean, this goes back to how people are able to use the Bible as a whip, is using it in this sort of mosaic sense of, let me take this verse out of this context, pair it with this verse in order to construct my own new narrative that is completely inconsistent with what I say about people who I dislike and people who are doing sin that I want to criticize, who have stepped outside of the community that we are in, use it as a punishment on them, but then completely, you know, rearrange the pieces to then condone some of the most explicit instances of sexual sin that you will ever see.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. I took a client out to a gun range one time, open range out in the field, and I set up a few, you know, Coke cans, and we went back a few yards and I let him shoot. Well, he got really lucky and hit one, and he got so excited. He was holding the gun. I had trained him how to hold the gun, how to be careful, all of the safety, all of the stuff, right? He was holding the gun carefully. He shot it, got lucky, and he got so excited, he turned to talk to me and pointed at me.
Yeah.
Which is violating the number one golden rule. And yeah. I violated the second rule, which we should have stopped, and I should have taken it out of his hand at that point. I calmed him down. I said, look, you can't do that. You can't point at other people. Let's, you know, you want to aim there, not me,
right,
or anybody else here. Well, he did it a second time. And that's when I packed it up and I said, we can't do this. You probably shouldn't be doing this that we're doing.
Yeah.
And I took it out of his hand. I mentioned that they're using the Bible like this. People who don't know how to use the Bible are using it. Well, here's the difference. You have a bunch of people who are doing exactly what that guy did, but with the Bible. They're pointing it loosely, at like a loose cannon, at this person, at this person, at this person. Where it gets really interesting, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but usually the sins of the person who's preaching are that's the sins that they're preaching the most about.
Yes.
the ones that they really struggle with, that's what they're going to preach about. And so you can really tell it, and they will often combine verses to show forgiveness for that particular sin because they too want to be forgiven, which makes sense, but yet they're still holding the loaded weapon and they're still pointing it randomly at all of the people, right? Here's the problem. Because I know for a fact that this happens. I have seen this happen. Leadership doesn't really care whether you know the Bible or not. They watch people do this. They get excited because if you can combine two verses and make something beautiful that isn't in the Bible, it's a new beautiful creation. Let's preach about it. They love it. They especially love it if you, during the course of the sermon, pay your respect to the leader. So you get these group of people with loaded weapons that are pointing randomly who give a blessing to, you know, the top elites in the cult. Well, suddenly they're favored, even though they don't know the Bible. And you watch them rise through the ranks faster than somebody who doesn't give praise to the leader. I've watched this happen. And at the same time, they still have a loaded weapon that's just pointing randomly. They don't know what they're going to hit with it. The leadership doesn't care as long as they pay the respects. The problem is there is no accountability. There's no structure. There is no training of theology. So as you're rising through the ranks, your rank and file member assumes falsely that they are studying and learning and being trained on how to preach. No, it's usually not the case, although you do have a few theologians, but for the most part, the movement frowns on any type of biblical knowledge. So in my opinion, what happens is you rise through the ranks, and as long as you can pay tribute to the leader, they really don't care where you point that gun, as long as the gun is not pointing at them.
I think of that analogy of the gun, like, that makes so much sense. It's funny that you were saying it, because I remember an exact situation with my dad where, like, despite growing up in the Midwest in a conservative community, and so there was a lot of times where I went to the gun range and a lot of gun use, you know, because that's just part of the culture there. And my dad would go, but everybody within our community knew that he wasn't really allowed to handle the guns because he just wouldn't take things seriously. He didn't take rules seriously. And so he would shoot something and then he would laugh and kind of turn and absentmindedly then point the barrel of the gun towards people. And it got to the point where it was like literally like, no, Bob cannot have a loaded weapon. And he even understood some of this to some point. Like he probably was offended by it, but he stopped asking for it because he just could not follow the rules. And that was true of him entirely. And it's why he was able to rise to the top of places like Bethel, because he was able to shoot from the hip and do whatever he wanted, go up, be bold enough to give prophecies that he had pulled off of Facebook. And it was rewarded at places like Bethel. I think that it's like, it actually is very appropriate that the people who cannot be trusted with weapons are also the people who are being elevated because they just have no shame shame isn't the right word. I mean, that is the right word for my dad, but it's also not the right word for exactly this. They have no sense of responsibility. And that is something that is rewarded in there. And I think of the people who metaphorically who are the ones wielding guns in my upbringing when it comes to judgment, right? So I think the most poignant example I think is Lou Engle, because for other people, like, Lou Engle is is someone who is this another figure who speaks about these things and is, he's a public figure for a lot of people. That's not how it was in my world. Like, he literally was the dad of friends of mine. Like, he was, I grew up with Lou Engle. He would speak to our like youth group a bunch before he even got, I don't know if famous is the right word, but before he got the level of authority that he does, like Lou Engle, and he was always the way that he is, you know, he's rocking with his voice that is thrashed and you can't totally understand him, but he had this ethos of just someone who is scary. And he still demonstrates that. And every single time he talks, I mean, it is his entire ministry is about the wickedness of America and its politics. It's anti, of course, LGBTQ, anti-abortion, but not in a way that it's just political. Like, he would talk about the murder of innocent babies as like a Holocaust. And the way that he campaigned about these things and continues to do this is so intense. And so he was someone who I remember my dad talked about Lou about, and he would talk about him having a justice chip. And this is something that Mike Bickle would say too. Lou just has a justice chip because he wants justice and he sees these examples of injustice. So just homosexuality in general being a measure of injustice, or sexual immorality in general just being injustice, and this is what's wrong and we have to repent as a community. Hurricane Katrina, Lou Engle spoke about how Hurricane Katrina was judgment on New Orleans for being a sexually lawless town. Now, think about that. We talked about that earlier of how individually how people's health will be used against them if you're, you know, having to go to the dentist because of a toothache that could be representative of like God punishing you for something that you did sinfully, or sin, allowing sin to wreak havoc on you because of, you know, decisions that you have made. To be so bold as to say one of the most devastating natural disasters that happened in certainly within recent American history was caused because of the sexual lawlessness of a city, and as judgment, I mean, he compared it to it wasn't Sodom and Gomorrah, he compared it to Nineveh and Jonah coming and speaking to Nineveh. Now, Nineveh wasn't judged but because they turned from their ways, but he said that it was like a modern day Nineveh. And I remember this, I don't know if this is public. I remember him saying it. This is when I was still in high school. And I remember him having that. And I remember thinking, oh my God, and believing him and thinking of like, wow, like that helped me form my opinion of who God is and was based off of this incredibly judgmental, thing that a leader in my community, a father in my community was saying. And ever since 2023, when it came out that Mike Bickle was perpetually and systemically grooming young women and had been doing this since, you know, the 70s or 80s, my mother being one of the victims of this, Lou Engle has not said a damn thing.
There are so many people who have been bruised by this movement and are suffering, and they leave and they go into another church, and it's a gospel for the suffering. It's a gospel to lift up the people and lift their spirits. That's what the gospel is when you go to another church. But in this type of environment, this revival community, it's a gospel of entertainment. It's a gospel of wow. It's a gospel of let's get excited, let's get political, that kind of thing. And they do it, like you said, by stringing these phrases together and then marrying them together, making a new book of the Bible. What you're describing is one of the problems that comes from that type of mentality. When you're in a best way to to say it is, these revivals aren't really revivals. Revival is refreshing, renewing, becoming closer to God. This is a rally. These revivals are actually rallies. And in a rally, you have a rally cry. And that's what they're doing. If you can build the excitement up to rally state, then everybody gets excited, everybody falls out. And they do it, like you said, by stringing loaded language phrases. Well, the problem is you can't have a rally while also appealing to the people who are suffering and giving them the, you know, the help that they need. That doesn't work. You can't have both. And so it's not a popular message. And as people rise through the ranks, you know, I don't know much of Lou Engle's background, but I have seen others like him who rose through the ranks because what happens is as you repeat those phrases and you string them together, you learn which combinations excite the people and get them all worked up in the, they call it worked up in the spirit, but it's literally worked up in a rallying state.
Yeah.
Well, the passages for the brokenhearted don't do that. Mm-hmm. And so they don't go to those. So those phrases aren't there. And what happens is you have people who are called, quote unquote, mature in the spirit, who haven't really learned how to appeal to the people who are brokenhearted. And so they don't know what to do. They get into a place like this. It may not be that he even, you know, maybe he wants to. Maybe he wants to appeal to these people. I don't know. But many people like him just simply don't know how because they've never done it.
Yeah. And it's not, again, it's not profitable because stirring up either frenzy against the people who are in your own community, right, and is not profitable, as I have clearly seen myself, you know, where like I can speak very poignantly about people in my own life because it's actually from a place of like, this was wrong and I would like to see this changed. And it's not, that's not going to, if your goal is to gain power, where are you gaining power? You can't criticize the very structure that you are in because then you, you know, you, the tide recedes and you, your boat sinks with it. So there's not profit in it. And like you said, there's not profit in then being nuanced and understanding and being like, okay, I understand I'm a Republican, but I believe that there's a lot of good people who are also Democrat. And like they, I understand that there, this is a more nuanced conversation about sexuality and two consenting adults. Like you cannot have a compassionate understanding of the other side and sell tickets as much, right? It just doesn't, You can have some influence and you can do good things and you can still advocate for your political opinion and whatnot by being measured, but you're certainly not going to get as much money. And I know that it seems crass to boil it down to all just money and power, but I think that that's why, you know, moths to the flame. Like this is why people like Lou Engle and Bob Hartley and Mike Bickle and Bob Jones and Bill Johnson and Chris Fallotton are drawn to these communities and drawn to this specific branch of Christianity. Because again, it is a hyper-specific, it's a leaf on a twig on a branch of a tree within a forest. Like this is a very specific subset of a subset of Christianity that is distinctly set apart from the rest of the subsets of Christianity, specifically because it is more judgmental. Because, Bill Johnson, in one of his books, talked about how cessationalists, like, so people who do not believe in the gifts of the Spirit or believe that they ceased, are, oh, how did he say it? It is a lie, it's a demonic lie that they're perpetuating. So not even, I mean, it's one thing to be like, hey, people who are of a different religion are demonic, or people who are of a different political belief are demonic, which, again, that is also pretty extreme because you can have differences of opinion without demonizing everyone who disagrees with you. But he even is, I mean, this is an example of someone who's being like, everybody without my like specific subset of denomination is all demonically influenced. And it's only us who have the chosen, you know, group. And same with like Mike Bickle and being like, hey, we believe that anybody who preaches pre-trib rapture is being demonically influenced. Like, that's how specific Mike Bickle was getting about some of these things. And I mean, the only reason you are drawn to those communities is because you want power and money, because it's profitable, because you want to feel like you are the forerunner for God, and you want hundreds of thousands of people to come to your conferences and say, this man is going to help usher in the end times. This person, Mike Bickle, he is going to be one of the leaders of the forerunner church, the bride of Christ. And that stroked his ego. And I mean, with Mike Bickle, with my dad, with others, my dad loved feeling like he was the mouthpiece of God, even though he knew he wasn't, because he had gotten it off Facebook, even though he knew that this was not coming from God, that it was not a dream where God showed up at the foot of his bed. Like, he knew that didn't happen. He knew that he was on an iPad in the morning and had searched through someone's name and wrote it down and everything like that. Yet the joy that it brought him to speak and have thousands of people think that God had showed up and spoken to him about these different individuals, and to watch them double over with tears in their eyes and be brought to the point of like dropping to their knees because they believe that God is speaking through him. He relished and lived for that power. And that is what all of this, the mosaic that we've been talking about, it's breaking the Bible up into little sections so that you can say whatever you want, is in order to seek out that power and that prideful position of feeling like you can speak and use God's language and you can be the mouthpiece of God. And the only way to actually do that is to break up what was said in the Bible, and in order to fit you and your beliefs, unless you spend your entire life dedicated to learning truth and having, and as we've already said, there's a humbling process of going through that. And these people would rather skip that process or never engage it at all. And so we have these very clear instances of people who are making a desecration of these biblical principles in general, because it's not about the Bible. It's not about God. It's not about what Jesus spoke. It's not about any of that. It's about using the Bible to leverage their own voices. So, because they like hearing their voices, they like, you know, speaking so loud, they hear their voice echo back and say, oh, listen, that's God. Don't you hear God on the air? And it is so infuriating how it is cyclical and it keeps going around and around and around. And people and victims are being silenced because of these prideful individuals who love hearing their voice so much.
Well, as I said before, they're using the Bible like a weapon. They're shooting it randomly. But the good news is every single person who's in that building can defuse it just simply by walking out. You right. walk out and they don't hear their voice. You know, you can speak to wind all you want, but whenever you don't have an audience, you kind of think, well, wait a minute. I wonder if what I said caused all of this. I wonder if what I said caused them to leave. Then they start checking themselves, and all it takes is one person to stand up and say, you know, you were stringing together a lot of passages that don't really go together. I want to hear the Bible instead. And that's really all it takes. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, John.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.